Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Welcome to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and part of the Christians for Liberty Network. I am your host, Doug Stewart, and I have with me today Cody Cook. Cody has a BA in Biblical and Theological Studies and an MA in Biblical Studies from God's Bible School and College in Cincinnati, Ohio. He's a contributor to LCI, the Libertarian Christian Institute, and author of the book, and I'm going to hold it up here, The Anarchist Anabaptist, Essays on Radical Christianity and Freedom. That's what we're going to talk about today. Cody, I just got my proof copy of your book in the mail today, and I wish you had gotten yours as well today. Hopefully you'll get yours tomorrow for us to kind of review the final draft of this. But by the time everybody hears this, they will be very close to being ready to pre-order. So I'm really excited to talk to you about your book. Thank you for being here, man.
Hey, thanks for having me. Yeah, show the inside of that. We had some great typesetting done on that.
Yeah. Let me see if I can find the one internal page here. It makes sense
to do. The inside looks prettier than any other book that I've done. So,
okay. So we have, for those only listening, okay, if you're watching, the green screen's doing a little bit of weird stuff, but you can kind of see that it's really well typeset. We've got a little bit of graphics in here. The typesetter did an amazing job on that. And, you know, we're going to talk about the cover too here in a minute, because I know you had a friend help you with the cover on this, which is something that not all authors get the privilege to do, Cody. So you should be thankful that we let you do that. So one other important thing to note here is you've probably already heard Cody's voice if you're listening or watching, because Cody has been the host of at least a couple episodes now of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. He is now joining me as co-host. We're going to pinch hit for each other, I guess, or go back and forth. I don't know what the term is. Trade off. That's the word, because we're all about trade-offs. we're going to trade off between guests so that you can get an even greater variety of voices on our show. And I don't mean that as in like, hey, you don't have to listen to me and review everybody all the time. But you also don't have to only go with the kinds of things that I'm interested in. I'm bringing in Cody and some of his interests, which overlap with mine, of course, in a number of ways. But it's going to be the same great show. And this is a great episode to start off our year talking about something that Cody's doing, which is publishing at least one book. He's going to tell you about the other one that he's doing. But anyway, I want to talk about the cover, Cody, because the title of your book is The Anarchist Anabaptist. And so you're going to tell us about the Anabaptist in this book. So the Anabaptist on the cover, why does he look so violent? Why is he committing violence?
Well he's not. If
those of you not watching, go watch on YouTube.
Yeah, if you look closely at the image there, he appears to be like a street anarchist type, and he's throwing what looks like a bomb or a Molotov cocktail. But it's actually, if you look closely, it's a peace sign with a flame around it. So the idea is that you're sort of getting something that you don't expect, two things that are paired together in a way that's sort of surprising. And so, basically, what's that? That's the theme of the book, is that anarchism, libertarian anarchism in particular, and Anabaptism, those that 16th century movement that arose out of sort of Protestantism that they call the Radical Reformation, and mostly is known today by Amish and Mennonites and Hutterites. Those are those strange people you see driving horses and buggies. That basically, there's a significant amount of philosophical overlap between those two philosophies, between anarchism and Christian Anabaptism. And what I argue in the book is that this classical liberal tradition from which libertarianism and anarchism are derived, that actually was preceded by Anabaptism 200 years almost before classical liberalism came into being. This group of radical Christians in Northern Europe rediscovered these ideas in the New Testament. that's really kind of what we're doing. I'm hoping to give to encourage libertarians, especially Christian libertarians, to give Anabaptism a second look, because it is a Christian movement. But also, I think what I really want to do too is remind Anabaptists of their heritage and its influence. And so there's kind of a twofold goal with this book.
So have you, so that second goal there about reminding Anabaptists of its influence and its heritage and so forth, that to me, there was something, I think Kevin Vallier said this on a website about 10 or so years ago, that he was talking about how it seems kind of strange that you wouldn't have more Anabaptist interested in libertarianism because there's so much about peace. Like the half of the argument has already been made that we're for things that are peaceful, right? So tell us about how you address that a little bit. I mean, is that, well, first of all, does that kind of feel that way to you?
Yeah, I mean, so what you sort of see in contemporary Anabaptism, you have a kind of a strong separatist idea, which is a form, really a form of Christian anarchism, because not all Christian anarchists are necessarily mm-hmm. activists. Some of them are just saying, well, Christ is my king, and I really don't care what the state does, right? And so that's one strain that you'll have in Anabaptism. And then you have some other strains that I think kind of cheat a little bit, because they'll sort of, you'll have like the kind of progressive Mennonites who, you know, vote for, you know, Kamala Harris or whatever. And then, you know, then you'll have some of those Amish folks who are supposed to be completely separate from the world, and then they line up to vote for Donald Trump or George W. Bush or whatever. And so what you don't see a lot of, though, is really this emphasis on libertarian anarchism. There's not really a big strain of that in Anabaptism. And that's, I think, sort of surprising in a lot of ways, because there is so much philosophical overlap. And I think the reason that so there's probably a lot of reasons why those things didn't connect. But I think part of it was because Anabaptists tended to be so separatists from culture and from politics that mm-hmm. when the what we now call the classical liberal tradition was developing, it just wasn't really on their radar. It wasn't really something that they cared much about. And insofar as they do start to kind of veer into the world and that kind of worldly politics thing, I think that they tend to take on, you know, sort of what's on the surface. And I think there are, you know, some Anabaptists who feel comfortable with what's kind of on the left, because especially the progressive left, because you sort of get that anti-war thing, and you get stuff that sounds, you know, kind of nice, love of neighbor, concern for neighbor, and, you know, welfare, you know, all the kind of social welfare, and a lot of that stuff gets couched in that language that feels very comfortable, I think, for Anabaptists. But the unfortunate thing is Anabaptists talk so much about nonviolence, and they don't really acknowledge those who are on the progressive left that the state functions on violence. It requires violence to do its thing. And so that's, I think, one of those sort of contradictions that gets relieved when someone who is an Anabaptist starts to really consider libertarianism or libertarian anarchism.
Yeah, I was talking with somebody about this earlier today, and I was just like, you know, when I talk to my Anabaptist friends, I'm like, you guys are like most of the way there. It's like, you just got to realize that there's no special carve out for the state, and you'll be truly, fully pacifists. But we'll talk about the conflict there, because I can hear all of the libertarians just bristle when I said the word pacifist, which we'll talk about here. But I often wonder, though, do you think that the reason why you would have an Anabaptist kind of go left-leaning in the sense of like political action and activism, because that tradition did have a strong emphasis on justice, caring for people, and all of this sort of emotionally attractive programs that are particularly leftist in America, as opposed to the separatist ones, which, you know, doesn't feel like anything's getting done if you're just being separate. I mean, you know, Amish for social justice isn't a banner around where I live here in Pennsylvania, but, you know, Amish for Trump, or, well, I don't know about Kamala, but a lot of Mennonites are probably voting for Kamala. I don't know, but.
Yeah, I mean, I think the anti-war thing is really a big part of it too, that, you know, in when the anti-war movement was kind of gearing up in the 60s and the 70s, if you were an Anabaptist who was watching the news, you would sort of say, well, these people are saying what I say. They're saying what I think, right? And what's interesting there too is, I think libertarians have a similar problem in that anytime someone seems to be saying something that sort of sounds anti-war, we go, well, you're on our side. And then that's not necessarily always the case. Yes.
Well, they're on our side for being anti-war. That doesn't mean they're on our side.
Yeah, well, for example, Murray Rothbard, who, by the way, referred to Anabaptists as virtual anarchists, we're talking about the 16th century early movement. You know, Rothbard, before he sort of made his sort of compromise with the paleos.
That's funny that the word virtual is used, because, first of all, we're talking about
people who have historically not used technology.
There we go.
And also the word, because the word virtual on my mind, like virtual. Oh, wait, not that kind of virtual.
Yes. Rothbard, I mean, made sort of similar compromises with the left because he felt like there was this anti-war movement that maybe libertarians could, find some common ground on. And certainly there was some common ground, but it ended up not being as an effective pairing as he'd hoped. And I think, sometimes, we in the libertarian camp, we see like among Christian nationalists, for example, that they're sort of anti-war. And the reason they're anti-war is very different than the reason we're anti-war. They just don't want to spend, have us spending our money on brown people. There's a seeming commonality, but the motivation is very different. And I think Anabaptists' philosophy, I think they see what's going on the left, the progressive left, not the regular left. And they think, well, maybe we have some kind of brothers in arms, so to speak, spiritual arm.
Yeah. Okay.
But that's not necessarily the case.
Okay. Well, so tell us a little bit about your journey. I'm sure you share this I know you were on Jacob's show or you were on the Green Room recently. And so I'm sure you might've shared some of this there and maybe even with me on air or whatever, but just for people maybe just tuning into to our conversation here, where did you come into either the liberty space and your interest in Anabaptism?
Yeah, I'll give the short version just in case someone did listen to the recent conversation I had with Jacob.
Okay.
And I was always, I've been kind of anti-authoritarian since my youth, but it was never necessarily like something I thought out very carefully, Mm-hmm. So I would sort of vacillate between like kind of, left-wing socialists, Abbie Hoffman and the Yippies, Black Panthers. I read like Bobby Seale and Abbie Hoffman's memoirs. Nobody knows who those people are except for maybe old people who used to be hippies. But then I would also sort of go the other direction sometimes. I'd watch Alex Jones videos or something. And so I would kind of go anywhere that seemed to be sort of anti-authoritarian, but I didn't have like a very clear, philosophy that was developed. So that sort of comes later as you have conversations with people and you hear certain names and certain ideas come up and you sort of go, okay, well, non-aggression principle. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And so what does it look like to follow that out practically and put it together logically?
So you're a principled anti-authoritarian now.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I guess the Christian side is, I was raised, so my mom's side of the family was kind of nominally Christian. My dad's side of the family were Southern Baptists. So I was baptized in Southern Baptist Church. And so then by the time I was 11, I was, of course, an atheist. And so, not to diss the Southern Baptists who are listening, it didn't work out for me. And so then I sort of slowly came back to it bit by bit, I think because I'd been taught certain traditions that weren't really true and that were unhelpful. Chesterton said something about how once he'd sort of put all the finishing touches on his heresy, he realized that it was orthodoxy. And that was me because I sort of said, I'm not going to take anything for granted. I'm going to put this together. You say that Jesus is God. I'm going to look at that. And so like for a while I was like, maybe I'll join the Jehovah's Witnesses because I'm not sure about Jesus being God. And I kind of looked through the scriptures and I was like, no, he's God. Okay. So then maybe the Holy Spirit. So I was in Bible college, my second semester as like a binitarian, because I wasn't convinced that the Holy Spirit was. Because I wasn't convinced the Holy Spirit was God. And so then in a class on the book of Acts, I was like, okay, I'm Trinitarian now. Right. Kind of hit me. And so I've sort of managed to become, I think people would disagree with me on certain things, but I've become essentially an Orthodox Christian just by kind of searching it through. But in the process, like when I started becoming a Christian, it was like I have kind of an obsessive compulsive personality type. So it's like, let's figure this thing out and understand it and the ins and outs. Mm-hmm. You start researching church history, stuff like that. I ended up in Bible college. I didn't really have a career goal. I just wanted to learn more, Mm-hmm. And so once you start looking in history, you go, these Anabaptist people are really interesting, And I wasn't necessarily sure about the Christian pacifism thing, but it sounded interesting. And but I think just their, they were so different, I think, from the Protestant Reformation, mm-hmm. That basically until... from about 391 AD to the Protestant to up to the Anabaptists, The church seems pretty much united in its acceptance that you have to have the force of government propping up the church, that the church and state have to work together to build a Christian society that's maintained by the threat of force. The early church didn't believe that. And then the Protestants sort of come around, the mainstream Protestants, and they don't really believe that either. And so they don't quite go back to the early church or the Sermon on the Mount. They say, back to the Bible, and then they get to Augustine, and they say, well, that's good enough. And the Anabaptists, it seemed like, were really wanting to go back to the Sermon on the Mount. They were really interested in what the church looked like in the first couple centuries and wanting to model that more. And part of that was, they coalesced around certain key ideas that sometimes don't sound like they fit together, but they really do. So the baptism of believers only. They didn't practice infant baptism like all the Protestants did. And, you know, those who are listening who are Baptists or Pentecostals might be surprised to find out that Martin Luther and John Calvin practiced infant baptism, that the only people who were believed in believers' baptism at this time were the Anabaptists. And part of the reason why it was so important to them was because they believed that faith should be voluntary. And infant baptism was a way that someone could be born not only into the church, but into the state, the Volkskirche, the people's church, the people's state, right? Hmm. And so the nation state, essentially, we call it the nation church. And so they felt that, you know, that was not really a legitimate Christianity, a state Christianity, because it was something that you didn't choose. It was something that you didn't necessarily believe. You just sort of pretended to accept it, or maybe you did accept it, but it didn't really matter if you did or didn't, because you had to act like it.
Right. Yeah. And what's the constitutional law or whatever that if you're born in America, then you're automatically a citizen?
That's birthright. Birthright citizenship in the 14th Amendment.
Yeah. So it's a sort of like I don't know. It just seems to me like that sort of method of like, hey, we're gonna make a Christian state and we're gonna fill it with people by virtue of your birth.
Yeah. And you know, Stephen Wolfe, who wrote the Case for Christian Nationalism, he makes this point kind of strongly in the book. He says, like, well, you know, we'll of course welcome Baptists into the movement, but they're not really, really properly suited for Christian nationalism because they don't believe in infant baptism. And so, I mean,
that's a pretty specific doctrine to exclude people from being part of Christian nationalism. That's crazy. Well,
but he's you know, whatever else you have to say about him, he's tracking with what was going on in the 16th century, with what with Calvin and Luther.
So that's how that connects here. Yeah.
Right. And so the Anabaptists sort of said, well, we don't believe in coerced religion. We don't believe in really violence, or especially lethal force. And we think that the church should be separate from the state, and the church should be kind of distinct from the world. And so in trying to join them together in this way, infant baptism was, I mean, there's of course theological arguments for it as well. But it's at least at this time, maybe, you know, obviously Presbyterians and Lutherans and, you know, people like, you know, Carrie and Greg, who hosts the Reformed Libertarians podcast, they don't think of it in this political sense, but the 16th century Protestants did that. Mm-hmm. And so did the Catholics, that you are baptized into the state. Now, the only people who weren't baptized into the state were Jews, and Jews were not considered Christians, and they also weren't considered citizens. Hmm. So really this whole little dispute about something that seems like kind of this weird adiaphora thing, you know, whether you baptize infants or whether you baptize believers, this really sort of became like the starting point for Anabaptist theology that led them into all these other things.
Yeah. Okay. So when you were learning about Anabaptism, you were saying that they're really interesting people and things like that. Was it like their faith and their ethics and their practices and how they approach the scriptures? Is it that lined up for you in similar ways that you rediscovered your faith, or was it things like they answered questions the way that like a sort of seeking Christian finds libertarianism and sees it as like, ah, that's answering that question for me. How was that experience for you?
I think it was partly the anti-authoritarian sense of it, that they were sort of willing to do what they felt was right.
It's a good thing you actually read into or studied the right Anabaptists too.
Well, there you go.
Because that's not, I mean, because, you know, seriously, that's not, I know Anabaptists because for those who probably, if people have been listening to this show, they know that I live in Amish country and there's a lot of Mennonites in my area. And so and my kids are in a choir that is predominantly Mennonite or run by Mennonites anyway. I run into them all the time, right? Unlike Jacob, who only sees them as on men's retreats from his church because that's where they go. I bump shoulders with Mennonites every week. And so I know, and I'm not, I have no particular people in mind, and I'm not talking about the necessarily people that I bump shoulders with, but that there is a sense of, well, you just kind of do what the government says because they're informed by experts. And so, you know, you can kind of guess where that's going. And so I don't always have that impression of the Anabaptist movement, but you're saying that the history is such that it is more anti-authoritarian than maybe some of them today give the impression of.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. And you know, I think part of the appeal for me too was, you know, thinking in terms of that anti-authoritarianism, thinking in terms of wanting to create a sort of a voluntary faith. They were the only ones who were really saying that. And like, you know, as sort of someone who was kind of found himself in this sort of vaguely Protestant space, the first thing you start to do when you read history as a Protestant, church history as a Protestant, is you go, man, those Catholics were mean to us Protestants, right? and then you find out that if you read outside of Fox's Book of Martyrs, that Protestants were also killing Catholics. and then it turns out that the only people who weren't killing somebody for religious reasons were the Anabaptists. And so with the exception of a few weirdos who tried to take over Munster because they said the pacifism ethic had ended because the millennium had come and that Munster had become the new Jerusalem. But everybody else in the Anabaptist movement thought those people were nuts.
How big was that movement? Do you know in terms of size and scope? I mean, yeah.
I know I've come across some figures, but off the top of my head, I'm not sure. I know that they sort of brought people in from kind of who were maybe sympathetic from other places.
Yeah, okay.
I want to say it was like in the hundreds, but I'm not sure off the top of my head, those who were kind of,
yeah.
But essentially they held the city for a while until the prince wouldn't tolerate it. And then it ended as badly as you could expect.
It's like a footnote in terms of like, it's a pretty trivial number.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah. And I think also Anabaptist eschatology was changed by that as well, because they were already sort of suspicious of date setters. But like once that happened, you had like people like Menno Simons who said, well, yes, Jesus is coming back soon, but like, let's not set any dates about this because like, that's just going to get us into trouble.
Right. That has gotten us into trouble. Yeah. Well, and so how soon after that incident, and I think this is important to note because some people bring this up as like, well, they're not all pure. They weren't all purists. But like, if this was a sort of aberrant thing, did the tradition itself, sort of, so what's the word? Anathematize? Is that the word I'm looking for? Maybe that event, or did it take a while? Did they just kind of do a John Howard Yoder and, you know, turn the other way and not mention it for a while?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely
see... That was a deep cut, by the way.
You definitely see it in the writings that that were being produced, that they were really embarrassed by the fact that this was happening.
Okay.
At the time...
Like at the time later, or soon after?
Yeah, even at the time. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, because this wasn't... I mean, Anabaptists as a rule at that time were already really leaning into the pacifism thing. I mean, even those who did this at Munster... We're saying, well, sure, we're pacifists until the end comes, but the end has come. And right. So even they were sort of doing this kind of, you know, little dance where they were sort of saying, well, yes, we're pacifists, but we're not. I think some Anabaptists will object to the word pacifism because they see it as kind of a left-wing political doctrine. Mm-hmm. So they may have used a word like non-resistant. At least that's the word that would be used today.
Yeah, I know Brian Zahn, who is not, he's more charismatic than Anabaptist, but he has a lot of a lot of overlap here, and is speaking at Anabaptist conferences. He doesn't like to use the word pacifist because of all the different connotations, and it has, you know, he lists all like a handful of them. It's like, well, it could mean that I'm just a person who believes in peace because of some other reason. I'm Buddhist or whatever. Like, pacifist doesn't actually communicate very much about what he actually believes, which is of course important to kind of note, because it's like, well, if you're a Christian pacifist, well, that's going to be different in the same way that being a Christian anarchist is different from being a, you know, an anarchist, you know, or, you know, communist anarchist or whatever flavors of anarchism you might want to talk about. So, we can talk about that here. I want to shift a little bit to the tensions that you bring up in your book, because again, the whole idea of, you know, we talked about your cover and the two different things that can go together. If anybody knows anything about the Anabaptists at all, They know that they are, you know, very community-based perspective. They're a little bit on the separatist side, depending on whether you're even the non-Amish Anabaptist traditions are a little bit on the separatist side, to some of them. But that's what they're kind of known for, right? So we're not going to engage in politics. We're not going to engage in the world. We're going to be very community-based. Maybe city on a hill is in some ways a way of describing it. And then you have libertarians, on the other hand, libertarian anarchism, who are like individualists to maybe the nth degree for a lot of them, right? And they're very engaged in some sort of political activism, maybe not in the active, you know, we think of political activism, you have this image of people out on the street, and that can happen. But we're LCI, we're politically active in the sense that we're trying to educate people to think in terms of freedom and prosperity and instead of, you know, coercion and control. And so that is an activism of sorts in terms of education. So these things don't look like they go together unless you think more deeply about it. So what are some of the, like, the first question I would ask is this: what reasons would a libertarian give for rejecting the Anabaptist faith tradition? Like, if you're trying to tell some a libertarian, and we have a libertarian Christian audience, not all of them are Anabaptist. I know they're not all Anabaptists. That's just, I know that, of course, because that would be really weird. I mean, that'd be great, I guess, but that would actually be pretty strange statistically. They're probably like, yeah, I can't be an Anabaptist because why?
Yeah, I think the first thing you're going to hear is that pacifism contradicts the non-aggression principle. The non-aggression principle being that libertarian philosophy, which says that it's wrong to initiate force against peaceful people. Whereas pacifism is rooted in the idea that Jesus says to turn the other cheek when violent people attack you. Now, the NAP would say, well, of course you can fight back if someone attacks you, right? But Jesus seems to say something else. Now, NAP is based on natural rights, that humans have a right to do something, like defend their lives. What I would say is Christian ethics is actually based on the idea that sometimes we actually set aside our natural rights to obey Jesus as our Lord. So is there a contradiction there? Is there not? What I would say is that the non-aggression principle is bare minimum ethics. It says, really just don't initiate force against someone who's peacefully minding their business. It doesn't really have anything to say about whether we should feed the hungry or clothe the naked or house, you know, the homeless. It doesn't say anything about sexual ethics, unless coercion is involved. And most importantly, for our purposes, it allows for lethal self-defense and doesn't require pacifism. And that could be, you know, a problem from a Christian perspective, because mm-hmm. Jesus does seem to require pacifism. Now, if you disagree with me on that, Jacob Winograd and I did a debate about this last year that you're welcome to listen to, and you can hear my argument for that as well as his.
Did you discuss it on your chat with Jacob recently on the green room?
Yeah, we did a green room.
Okay, so a little bit more going on there.
Yep, January 7th. For those who are and so we kind of went back and looked at some of that a little bit.
Okay,
So what I like to say is that if our pagan and atheist neighbors held to the NAP at a minimum, society would be a much better place. But that's not enough for Christians who are seeking to follow Christ. And importantly, Anabaptists don't say that you don't have a right to defend yourself. They say that if we're seeking to follow Christ, then we have a higher ethic than merely to just sort of be concerned about our rights. And we'll get into this in other ways as well, because their faith is a voluntary faith. They are not saying, you know, if you're not a pacifist, we'll kill you. They're saying, you know, insofar as we have a government, it has a certain kind of limited field of what it's supposed to do. Early Anabaptists, you can find them basically arguing very much like libertarians at times, saying, you know, they're there to stop people from, they're there to stop violent criminals and thieves and people like that. Menno Simons added a few other things on there too, like sexual perverts and and heretics, okay, which is kind of odd. But generally speaking, the Anabaptists sort of said, you know, there's this sort of delimited role for the state. They spoke out against, war profiteering and things like that. A lot of these things that we as libertarians are so concerned about. But they said, once you are part of the church, once you've joined yourself to Jesus and you've joined one of our voluntary communities, there is an expectation about how you're going to look at violence and what kind of interaction you're going to have with the state. Mm-hmm. And so some Anabaptists said, you don't get involved in the state at all. There were some who were a little bit more moderate. There was a guy named Pilgrim Marpeck, who was an engineer for the local government. And he was cool with that. But he said, like, you know, there's things you can do working with the government, like an Alex Bernardo type guy, Protestant Libertarian podcast, who's a public school teacher. But if you want to, like, join the military and kill people, or if you're going to be like a magistrate who's ordering people to be killed, that's a different thing. So I think an apparent tension here, but it's really not a tension, because ultimately, Anabaptists affirm the nap. They just sort of say that if you're a committed Christian, you do more than just the nap. Some of the other tensions that we could talk about and they're addressed.
Yeah, well, I have a question about that, and this might be a question. Like, the question can probably be answered by them, by listeners listening to your debate and your conversation with Jacob. But when it comes, the big question for me when it comes to abiding by the non-aggression principle, or do we have a higher ethic, comes to the potential conflict between, it's, how do I put it? The conflict between defending my rights and protecting the vulnerable that are around me. Okay. And so, and let's just take off the table lethal force, and maybe that's all that's there. But is it okay for me to use violence to protect somebody from shooting a kid? That's kind of the, like, okay, I don't need to care about my rights. I'm happy to give up my life. I'm a Jesus follower. You know, I'm not afraid to die. Those kinds of things are part of the way that I can think. But, like, I feel like there's still that obligation to protect the vulnerable. And I don't mean to be like, hey, let's just arm all the teachers so that, you know, none of that stuff. That's not the right way of thinking in my mind. The right way of thinking is to think through this in sort of the, like, well, the Anabaptist tradition, which is a nonviolent resistance. How do we build a world of peace so that this kind of thing is super rare? But what do you do when somebody is coming after a vulnerable? Is there that opportunity to defend the weak using some sort of violence or force or something like that? That's where the tension typically comes in for me of like, well, maybe I am a pacifist. Well, what about that one occasion? Or, you know, that's where I land.
Yeah. And, you know, looking at like the, so I've got another book coming out this year through Wipfenstock. That's an Anabaptist systematic theology, where I kind of poured through the early Anabaptist confessions. I looked through early statements from different Anabaptist leaders, and it's not always clear where they draw those lines explicitly. Where I have drawn the line, I think, is at lethal force. That that, you know, if you come at someone with intentional lethal force, that would be, I think, sort of out of bounds. Now, there's other force that could also be wrong and inappropriate. But, like, you know, for example, you know, Amish don't make any bones about spanking their kids, and so they're at least going to say that there's certain force that they're okay with.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of libertarians don't like that, and I completely understand why. But at least they're not drawing that line quite there, right? I draw the line at intentional lethal force, because it seems to me that you can't really love your enemy and also kill them. I think you can love your enemy and restrain them. I think you can love your enemy and you know, knock them out. I think you can even love your enemy and punch them sometimes. I think it's a much harder case to make that you can love your enemy and actually extinguish their life. So that's, I think, if I have to draw the line very firmly there, in some place I draw it there.
Yeah.
But I think there's also other situations where, like, you know, okay, well, it's not lethal force, but can I, like, you know, bully can I bully somebody or, like, you know, can I beat up?
Can an adult bully a bullying child to like threaten them, to be like, look, if you don't get in line and stop bullying these other littler kids than you, you're going to be in big trouble. I mean, that's a threat of force to some extent, but is that really?
Well, like, for example, like a parent who says, I'm going to spank you if you keep bullying kids.
Yeah. Something like, or a teacher. Yeah. 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 Alex Bernardo is going to go to the bully in the class. Alex is a friend of ours, host of Protestant Libertarian Podcast, so I can pick on him. He's going to go bully. He's going to go tell the kid, hey, look, I'm going to use the threat of the state to put you in detention if you keep bullying this other, the third grader.
Yeah, okay, I thought you were going to say that Alex is actually going to beat up the kid.
Oh, okay. So you're saying that you could threaten. Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, that would have been a better way to go, Cody. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, we used to have corporal punishment when we were a proper country, but no, I'm just kidding. But
what do you mean?
Yeah, this used to be a live debate, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's just like, it's like my dad, you know, any teenagers that are out of line, all they need is a good 8-week training with the military, basic training.
Yeah.
It's just like, they just need to be whipped into shape.
Yeah.
That's just kind of the answer. So on the other, and I know there's some other tensions that a libertarian would give for rejecting the Anabaptist tradition. Do you want to talk about any more, or do we want to switch to the other way around?
Yeah, I mean, we can. So, I mean, the other ones are that whereas libertarians tend to be really focused on individualism, Anabaptists are very interested in community. And so that looks different depending on the group. But even those who are fairly modern and contemporary and Western, they still see community as a really significant value.
Yeah. I don't really see that as a conflict. How do you deal with it, though?
Yeah, I don't see it as a conflict unless you want to define individualism as not just a political philosophy, but as like sort of a way of life, right? Mm-hmm. I can't join the church because then I'm not an individual. I can't work for, you know, Procter and Gamble because then I'm not an individual. I'm just a cog in the wheel or whatever, right? And so I think, you know, what it really goes back once again to whether or not these things are coerced. And so the collectivism of the Soviet Union is a coerced collectivism, whereas the communalism of, you know, a heterate community that where people sort of have a community of goods and they share things and they work together and they, you know, farm together. No one is there against their will, right? Everybody is there because that's the value that they care about. And so once again, I don't think there's really a tension there. There is, I think, a pattern of thinking that you're going to have in the West. It's kind of a not a political individualism, but kind of a day-to-day philosophical individualism that might be a little bit uncomfortable with that kind of level of communitarianism. But I also think that that's a lesson that we should be learning, to be honest, from Anabaptists, because I think, you know, we need to be affirming that political individualism. But we also have to remember that no man is an island, and that I think I have something in the book where I mention Hayek's point. Oh, actually, no, it's not even Hayek's point. It's Leonard. Was it Leonard Reed's point? The eye pencil.
Yeah,
where he says that, you know, all the different things that come together in making a pencil, you couldn't centralize that with one person or
it's
one.
It's like the main point of the most simplest illustration of a libertarian way of looking at economics, and it's like, no, we can't be our own, or we can't be on our own, like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Essentially, I mean, if you can't put together a pencil with all these sort of complicated, you know, interactions of different people and different, you know, communities and different you know, business or whatever, then how can you form an individual person by just leaving them on their own? So I think that there's something, you know, this idea of communitarianism is really, it's not just, I think, practical and obvious from like a sociological perspective. It's a very Christian perspective. You know, the church is the body of Christ. And so, I don't see a tension there unless we're defining libertarianism as not really just a political philosophy, but just this kind of, self-oriented egoism or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A moment ago, I was chuckling, and it might not make sense until I explain why, because I was going to interrupt, but then you were saying something way better. But you were saying people aren't, the community is where people are there voluntarily and not there against their will. And I'm thinking, yeah, all the Amish kids that are in our neighborhood are probably thinking, well, I didn't choose to be here. Why can't I drive a car or ride a bicycle or whatever?
Well,
they can ride bikes, but yeah.
Yeah, and there is, I mean, that is something to think about. I mean, that's something, a point that I make in my systematic theology is that, you know, Anabaptism was organized on the basis of voluntary relationships. But, you know, once you get a couple generations in, you know, there's kids who are there because they sort of feel like, you know, this is where I grew up. This is what I know. This is where my family is. The Amish, of course, do give those kids an opportunity to leave if they want to, but I think they taste the world, and sometimes they, you know, smoke meth and have premarital sex and all that other stuff. But invariably, almost all of them come back, and I think it's probably not only for religious reasons that they come back.
Yeah.
I think that it's what's comfortable. It's what's familiar.
Shunning is a very serious thing too, right? Like if it's not like they're allowed to just be out. They are given their time, and then at the same time, if you choose poorly, or whatever the line is, they're ostracized, and so that has its own power its own sort of threat of force. And it's kind of a different way of using the word force. I wouldn't quite call it force, but it's got its own teeth to it, you could say.
Yeah. Well, and I think that that's another thing to consider. Shunning in the 16th century means something very different than it means today. Today, we think about someone being shunned and we think how horrible that a parent could do that to their child, or that a church would do that to, you know, someone who goes, you know, who's a member.
Yeah.
But in the 16th century, the alternative to shunning was what Protestants and Catholics did. They burned you. And so, you know, the Anabaptists said, you know, we have to maintain order and we have to make sure that everybody who is here wants to be here. But also we have to really be that light to the world, that shining light on a hill. And we can't do that if people can sort of join and commit adultery and you know, cheat people and so on and so forth. That so this idea of social pressure becomes their sort of nonviolent way of dealing with, you know, dealing with those issues. The world kills people who break the law, and the Anabaptists, you know, apply social pressures to try to get them back on the straight and narrow.
Okay. I once asked Chuck Gutensohn, who's a very leftist guy who's also a pacifist, I said, would you be in favor of private prisons if the Anabaptists ran them? I don't remember what his answer was, but I just remember thinking, well, maybe that's a compromise.
Like, yeah.
You can get there. It's like, hey, we're going to restore you to the community. Like, that's the way to go, right? Like, reconciliation, restoration. All right. Why would an Anabaptist reject libertarianism?
Well, okay. So that's the other side. So yeah, there's different reasons why libertarians would not look at Anabaptism. They would see it as, you know, backwards or exotic or, you know, radical Christian. you know, there's not a lot of intellectuals who are in the habit of saying, I wonder what the Amish and Mennonites might have to contribute to my political philosophy. Christians, of course, are not going to like non-Anabaptist Christians. Many non-Anabaptist Christians are not going to like that commitment to nonviolence because they're from a tradition that sort of allows violence in certain contexts. But I think, you know, when you ask why are Anabaptists going to be suspicious of libertarianism, I think there's different reasons. I think, you know, starting back when the classical liberal movement is going on, I think they would just sort of see it as very secular and very worldly. It's not really, wasn't really relevant to their lives, even though there was so much philosophical overlap there. It was essentially a secular philosophy. It was not a, you know, it was not a Christian theology, you know? So that's part of it. I think there's also, you know, I think they're going to be concerned about these elements of that smack of selfishness, of individualism, of, you know, kind of being able to make your own way apart from the community. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a little bit suspicious to them. But at the same time, like, once again, what they're looking at, what they're wanting to try to build is a voluntary community. When you ask them, well, what should the world look like? Do you have an opinion about that? And they'd say, well, you know, I guess if there's going to be a state or a government, it should be limited in what it does. instead of going to war with its neighbors, it should be, you know, trying to maintain peace. Instead of punishing Christians and people who hold, you know, incorrect beliefs, those people should be allowed to kind of live
once
their
own lives.
Once
you get talking, there's a lot in common.
Yeah. And so, I think, you know, largely just that concern about it being so secular, I think would seem strange. For those who are kind of more on that progressive bent, I think what they're going to struggle with is that sense that libertarianism is ultimately a selfish philosophy.
Yeah.
Now, once again, though, what they're opting for is a collectivist philosophy that uses force and violence to get to accomplish its goals. And so, you know, I think libertarianism makes so much more sense for Anabaptists to consider than either what, you know, Trumpism or conservatism progressivism.
Yeah. Do you have conversations with Anabaptists that you've tried to convince to be more libertarian?
I've had a few.
How do they go?
So more open than you might expect. I haven't had a conversation recently on this subject with kind of more progressive Anabaptists. But I've talked to those who've sort of come in the movement from outside, and they're more responsive to libertarian ideas than you might think, especially considering they're a little bit suspicious of kind of political participation in general. I've actually gotten some pretty good responses when I've had some of these conversations. Just being able to kind of lay out what are the commonalities. I don't know that anybody has went and bought, you know, Rothbard's For a New Liberty yet. But the conversations have been productive, at least.
What about iPencil? That's free. I guess I don't need to go buy it.
Get. Yeah, it's easy to read. It's quick.
Yeah.
Start them off with the Tuttle Twins, maybe.
Yes, right. Yeah. No, that's good. I suspect that the people who have an issue with your combination of beliefs here are more the libertarians who worry about your Anabaptism. So that's probably more where you have the conversations where it either gets heated or contentious.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so for example, you know, friends who are Lutheran or Reformed or Pentecostal or whatever, but have these sort of libertarian leanings. What I would sort of say to challenge them is that I think many libertarian Christians have sort of just joined their libertarianism to their Christianity. You know, they see them as compatible, but they don't necessarily integrate them. I think, you know, I think there's a little bit of a tension there, though, because, you know, if you're Reformed or you're Lutheran, you're not going to find a lot in Calvin or Luther that's going to be really compatible with your libertarian philosophy. But mm-hmm. you're going to find an awful lot in the early Anabaptists that's going to be compatible. And so I think that there's much more of a clean integration that's going to happen coming as an Anabaptist into libertarianism, Christian anarchism, libertarian anarchism, yeah. than you're going to get from these other coming into these other movements. Now, you can put those things together, but you're going to have to saw off some pieces that don't fit. You're going to have to get rid of what Luther said about the state, or what, you know, what Calvin said about
what about
heretics.
I mean, to be fair to them, though, they would probably say that the tradition itself isn't beholden to, you know, like, as Calvin and Luther, they weren't like the replacement popes. So we don't have to believe everything they said about the state. And yeah. clearly, I mean, I know a lot of Reformed people who will say that they believe that Calvin and Luther were wrong on points that I actually would not have expected them to say Calvin and Luther are wrong on these things. And so I think the tradition takes on a life of its own over time. And the reconciliation is more than just sawing stuff off. It might be that they're just like, well, you know, one way to look at it from a Reformed lens or from a Lutheran lens or whatever is, you know, we've got this doctrine over here that kind of is compatible with libertarianism there. So it's probably a little less hacked. I don't know, to use your saw analogy.
So, well, I guess maybe the question I would ask is this. So if you're Reformed, you hold to these certain confessions. Now, you don't hold necessarily to the original confessions, you hold to the revised confessions. Why were those confessions revised? Why are you now a libertarian Christian instead of a statist Christian nationalist Christian? and the reason is,
somehow there was a divergence at some point in the tradition. Right.
And I think ultimately it was, you know, secular philosophy that shaped that. And it's not a secular philosophy that I disagree with. I mean, I think that there's a lot in that classical liberal tradition that's very good. But I don't think, you know, I think the Christian, the theological justifications for some of these things were in a lot of cases post hoc. Whereas I think if you start where the Anabaptists start and you're interested in trying to make a biblical case and, you know, starting with this idea of a voluntary religion, which was not what Luther believed or taught. It's not what Calvin believed or taught.
Yeah, okay.
Now, you might like their soteriology or their ecclesiology once you divorce it from the state. But you know, and listen, I get it. You're not going to give me a single Anabaptist source or confession that I'm going to agree with 100%. But what I will say is that there is, I think, a lot less tension about if you want to sort of pick a Christian tradition that's going to fit with libertarianism. I think there's a lot less tension you're going to get from Anabaptism than you're going to get from pretty much anything else.
There's like a difference between making it work and this just fits really well together.
Exactly. And I was going to say there's maybe one exception, like the Restorationists, because they did something sort of similar to the Anabaptists. They said, we're going to go back to the New Testament. A lot of them were sort of anti-state and pacifists as well.
Yeah.
So they had a sort of a similar pathway, I don't see that to disrespect, you know, any of the other traditions, but ultimately that's not my tradition. There's a reason why we disagree about things. And that's okay. You know, we don't have, I don't have to pretend that I agree with
if
them.
If you thought theirs was better, you wouldn't be an Anabaptist.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes, that's true. So it's almost like you kind of have to point that out nowadays because it's like, well, look, I did land somewhere here. You know, it's not like I'm, you know, trying to just be mean about it.
Right.
So we have a pre-order date set for January 21st of 2025. Now, this episode will release just before that. And so people can pre-order it. But before I tell them where they can pre-order it, why is that the date that we have set for pre-order?
Yeah, well,
other than that, we missed the deadline for getting it to be for order.
Yes.
Just kidding.
That was initially the date I was thinking about releasing it, but we needed a little bit more time to get it ready. Once it was something I wasn't independently releasing, and LCI was going to be involved, and was going to make it look so nice.
So you're blaming me.
No. It looks so much better now than what would have been if I released it myself. So yeah, January 21st, 1525, 500 years ago, there was something that happened that I would argue was the most revolutionary event of the Protestant Reformation, even though it seems pretty commonplace now. And it's what it was two followers of the magisterial Protestant reformer, Ulrich Zwingli, parted ways with him, and they illegally baptized each other. And they also chose not to baptize their new babies. And so that was seen as...
Keep the water away from them, ladies.
Well, yeah, I suppose you could bathe them. You just couldn't do it in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Yeah. And so, yeah. So,
sorry. The reason I'm chuckling about that is in one of the episodes of Young Sheldon, there was this battle over which faith the baby was going to be baptized in. And there was this scene where they were like, trying to baptize them in the sink, and they weren't even believers. It's just really funny.
It's funny.
That's way off topic. Go ahead. January 21st.
Yeah. So January 21st is built on, it was that day, basically that.
Yeah.
Many historians would say that marks the beginning of the Anabaptist movement.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, tell everybody where they can learn more about it, where they can sign up to be on the list so that when we do announce pre-order instructions, where can they get all the information? Well, not just now, but like when the book is out and they're like, hey, well, where do I get this? Where do we go?
Yep. So we bought the domain anarchistanabaptist.com. So that's a great place to go. I would assume Libertarian Christians would be a good place to look at here and there because yep. More information is coming out. Also our social medias, but anarchistanabaptist.com would be a great place to start. And to be clear, is pre-orders, are those Kindle pre-orders or are we doing paperback pre-orders as well?
Whatever Amazon lets us do. I don't have a technical answer for you.
Unless something's changed, I think it might just be Kindle pre-orders. So okay. if that's the case, the paperbacks would only be available when we release. And that
is, yeah, well, we can also, I think on LCI, I think I might have a way for that to be a paperback pre-release depending on different things. So,
in any case, the official release is February 18th.
Yeah.
Which I don't think anything ever happened in history that was important on February 18th. So that's just a date we picked out of a hat.
It's my birthday, man.
No, it's not.
I'm just,
okay.
Just thought I'd throw you a loop there. All right. Well, Cody, I am looking forward to getting this in the hands of as many people as we can. So for those listening and or watching, please visit anarchistanabaptist.com or libertarianchristians.com. You can go to store. We'll have it there when it's there for release. But January 21st, that's when you want to start doing the pre-order. And I'm going to hold this book up again for those watching. So for those of you listening, just hold on. This is the book. You can see the cover right now. Because you're watching on YouTube or wherever and not just listening. No. Thank you to all of our listeners. I'm throwing you under the bus a little bit only because I want to make light of I just want everybody to know that you can watch us on YouTube. I know sometimes it's like, well, why do you just want to listen to Doug and Cody talk about while they look at each other? Why can't I just listen and do something? But watching on YouTube is also a lot of fun because we're trying to incorporate a little bit more visuals for our shows. So In any case, Cody, thank you for joining us for this episode. Appreciate you being here and I'm really looking forward to how the year is going to shape up also with you being our host.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. We've got a few good recorded episodes in the can and a few guests who are lined up. So I'm really excited to be able to take a little bit of that off your plate.
Yeah, that's great, man. Oh, you know what? I just realized this is a bonus for everybody who didn't want to listen to us say the last few moments. You have another book coming out. So for those who've stuck around for the last minute or two, tell everybody about your other book.
Yeah. So I did kind of mention it, so it's going to be coming out through Whip and Stock. I just signed the contract. So unless they change their mind, And it's called The Pocket Anabaptist. And what it essentially is, it's a systematic theology of early Anabaptist thought. So it's kind of a systematic theology and kind of a historical theology in a way. Because it's not so much me sort of saying, here's what I think the Bible says, and I'm going to organize it in this way. It's kind of more like, here's what the early Anabaptists taught, and I've organized it in sort of a systematic theological
way. Okay.
Now, what's kind of neat about that is Anabaptists, they love confessions. They can actually be very systematic thinkers, but they haven't tended to write a lot of systematic theologies. And there's a few that have been released that are by Anabaptists, but they're always like a little bit, you know, kind of more individualized in a way. So it's like, I think there was one that was a guy who was an Anabaptist, but he was also a Molinist. So it was like an Anabaptist Molinist systematic theology. There was another systematic theology by the guy who didn't want to call himself an Anabaptist. So he used the word Baptist instead. And so anyway, this is really an attempt to take that sort of primary source data and organize it in such a way that if you want to say, okay, well, what did the Anabaptists think about soteriology? What did they think about Christology?
Okay,
did they have a view on whether or not the Holy Spirit proceeded from the Father and the Son, or did they think he just proceeded from the Father? All that's going to be there. So this is really exciting stuff, because I know that our audience has been wondering through this whole conversation, well, what about the Filioque? Do they think that the Holy Spirit proceeds not only from the Father, but also from the Son from all eternity? And the only way they can get the answer to that question,
I'm so glad I asked,
is to buy the Pocket Anabaptist when it comes out. I don't have a date for that.
Yeah, that's cool. Compared to the size and, well, not physical size, but like length, how does that compare to the Anarchist Anabaptist?
Yeah, so they're both very short books. My thing is, I love to write short books because I hate reading a book that's longer than it needs to be. If it needs to be long, I'll tolerate. That's fine. I understand. But if you give me a book that's 250 pages when it could be 150 pages, that is going to annoy the crap out of me. I got other things to do. So I don't repeat myself a lot. If you want to hear me repeat myself, you start the book over. And so yes, they're both about the same length. They're both really easy, quick reads. But I think they're packed with good information and interesting arguments.
Cool. All right. Well, we'll end the episode officially there.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you liked today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group. You are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.